Blog Talk Radio.
From my world tour of Iceland, Greenland, Switzerland, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Walla Walla, Pago Pago, and Perth Amboy, New Jersey. The Ant Canary Experience is back on the air. What's up? Did you miss me? I'm back. Good to be back. And I'm coming to you live from a new city. I'm not in Raleigh anymore. I'm in West Fayetteville, North Carolina, home of Fort Bragg, which is named after a Confederate general, like a lot of stuff down here in the South is, go figure. And in case you don't know, and I'm going to have to go take a picture of it and post it one day, downtown Fayetteville is a structure called the Market House, where they used to sell slaves at, right downtown. And it's still downtown to this very day, right in the middle of downtown. So I'm going to have to get down there and take a picture of it for you. But this is the Aunt Canary Experience. I am back on live after taking a short sabbatical. I am back. I'm live. I'm here. Going to be here till 8:30 tonight. If you want to call in, 563-999-3682, 563-999-3682. And we are going to be talking about today, the day after Labor Day. The subject of tonight's topic is who really built America. And I'm going to talk about that tonight because yesterday was Labor Day. A lot of you may have been off yesterday. I was already off because I'm off on Monday. So yesterday to me was just Monday. And we got a situation right now where we have a hurricane off the coast of Florida that people, I guess, weathercasters think may head up this way. We'll see. They're talking about it may hit this area, around this area, maybe Wednesday night, Thursday into Friday. So we'll see how that happens. Hopefully it'll take off and go some other way, but we'll find out. So stuff like that, you know, we're pretty, around here, we're pretty used to it. So it's hard to say it's no big deal, but it is a big deal. But we're used to it, so we'll see how that goes. I'll let you know what happens next week. I was checking the stats for my last show that I did before I took this short vacation, and I'm amazed at the numbers. It was a show I did on, had a collection of smooth jazz, and it looks like a lot of people liked it. And I thank you. Kind of shocked me. So I'll do another music compilation soon. The numbers were pretty good. I wasn't expecting that, but thank you. If you listen to it and you like it, I'll do another one for you. No problem. Not a problem. So like I said, tonight we're going to talk about who really built America. And I think some of you already know that. And I also think that there are some people, when we talk about slavery, which, matter of fact, last month was the, I guess, anniversary of 400 years, 1619 to 2019. And it seems like in this country, whenever, you know, black people want to talk about slavery, some white people want to kind of hide from it and pretend that, you know, that it never happened and all blah, blah, blah. But these are the same people that want us to remember the Civil War every chance we get. Like I said, I live in North Carolina, and around here, there's something named after somebody that fought in the Civil War, some Confederate soldier, general, whatever. And like I said a few minutes ago, Fort Bragg was named after a Confederate general. Down, I think Highway, I think it's 301. They have some, where they have reenactments of Civil War battles. My birthday was last month, so I went to, I like to celebrate my birthday in Baltimore, so I went to Baltimore. Coming back, you know, stopped off in D.C. and took a little tour, and was coming back through, and Virginia is slopping over with Civil War places. And as a matter of fact, and I need to remember to do this, there is a Civil War museum that is run by a sister, and I didn't know that, so I've got to check that out. And also come to find out that if you want to go to the African American Smithsonian Museum in D.C., that from the months of September, I want to say February, that if you go any weekday after 10, you don't need a pass to get in. I need to research that a little bit more. Cousin told me that. And if that's true, I got another road trip to plan. I got pictures to take, and I will let you know if that works. Matter of fact, when I was up there doing my little self-sightseeing tour, I forgot that it was summertime. Schools weren't back in yet. Tour buses all over the place and couldn't get in. So I'm going to try. I've got a little plan. I'm going to try to get in soon. And I'll let you know how that works. What else I got to tell you? I think that's it. I think that is all. But it's really good to be back. I hadn't done this in a while. I missed it. Hopefully I won't have to take another vacation. Matter of fact, I'm taking a vacation from work in a couple of weeks. But that doesn't count. I'm still going to do the show that week anyway, so it's no big deal. So I'm back, ready to get started on this topic. And why are we talking about this topic tonight? Well, we're talking about it tonight because, like I said, yesterday was Labor Day. A lot of people had off. A lot of people worked. And the question is, who really built America? Well, the answer to that question is black people built America. In the early days, black people built America. Slaves built America. Now, there's probably some people out there listening. Every time we talk about slavery, matter of fact, I did a couple of shows on this, and if I remember correctly, got into a back and forth with somebody. And every time you talk about this kind of stuff, certain people want to bring up the Irish. Well, the Irish weren't slaves. The Irish were indentured servants. Now, what is an indentured servant? Indentured servant. An indentured servant is someone who's not a slave. They work for somebody. They owe somebody some money. For example, somebody owes somebody $1,000. They don't have the money. So what they do is they come into an agreement with this person, and they'll work for this person until the debt is paid. Until the debt is paid, or sometimes it may be for a certain amount of time. But when the debt is paid and the time is served, they're released. They can go. They're free. The difference that and slavery is once you're a slave, you're pretty much going to stay a slave until the end of the Civil War when they were emancipated. But until then, they were a slave. So the difference is slave, you're pretty much a slave for the rest of your life. Indentured servant, you work until you pay off the debt. And then there's going to be somebody else saying, well, black people had slaves too. That's true. But they didn't have slavery in Africa like they had slavery in America. A lot of, and I'm going to play clips, and some of you clips are going to point this out. But the slaves they had in Africa were usually caught in battle, conflicts between groups of people, groups of tribes or whatever. So they were prisoners of war. So lots of times they would take these prisoners of war and make them work. Sometimes they would take these people into their, you know, the rulers would take these people, take some of these people and put it, you know, have them work in palace or whatever and take it. And sometimes they would take them and, you know, made them family. It just depended. So that's a difference. They did not pay other people to have these people. It wasn't chattel slavery. That's a difference. There was slavery where someone was paid for these people, and then slavery where people were caught as prisoners of war or conflict or whatever you want to call it. So there's the difference. Black people built this country, and that went in, that led into the capitalistic system in this country that we have. And there's some people think that capitalism is the best thing ever made on planet Earth. And it's not. It's okay for some people, but it's not okay for everybody. Because if it was okay for everybody, we'd all be rich. And as you can see from our sack of pus president, which don't know what the fuck he's doing, pardon my French, I don't care. He only cares about himself and other rich people like him. So for them, capitalism really works. For the rest of us, not so much. Because the simple definition of capitalism is, I'm going to do what I got to do to make more money than you. If I got to step on your neck to make more money than you, and I know that sounds harsh, but I mean, that's basically what it is. You want the most capital. That's why they call it capitalism. And capital can be money. It can be equipment, products, whatever. The thing is, I have to get more than you so I can become stupid rich. That's the way, I mean, that's what Walmart did. And I don't know if they did it on purpose, but, you know, before Walmart blew up like it did, I mean, we had Woolworths, we had the Five and Dime, and there were a lot of other places that we used to go shopping at. And I remember a few in my hometown. There was Jones's department store, Wood's department store, Nichols department store. I mean, there were, you know, stores like that all over the country, just small, you know, some were franchise or whatever. And then we had the what they call the mom and pops, you know, just simple general stores or whatever. Walmart comes and Walmart blows up and Walmart is all over the place. And I mean, hell, a lot of places, I mean, you can throw a rock somewhere and you will hit a Walmart. And Walmart's all over the place. And what happened to the smaller chains is that they pretty much, a lot of them went out of business because they couldn't compete. So Walmart, you know, if you want to say, you know, who won that war in capitalism, Walmart won that one, and they're still expanding, still, you know, because, I mean, it just gets to the point. It's to the point now, you know, you think of something that you need, you know, and I'm guilty of this too. Just go to Walmart, you know, and then it gets so, I didn't say bad, but then it gets so, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, certain Walmarts, you know, right off the top of the, you know, you got them already mapped out in your head where everything is. And there's a Walmart I go to that's close to my job. On the weekends, I mean, on Saturdays when I work, you know, we don't have the cafeteria is not open on the weekends, so you have to go and get your own lunch. And I go up in there every Saturday, practically every Saturday morning around the same time, and get my food, pay for it, and then leave and go to work. And I know where everything in that store is. I know where everything in that store is. Because I go in there at least once a week. Sometimes I go in there twice a week. And I know where the stuff is. So I can, you know, if I need something top of my head, okay, I need soap. I just go there and I know exactly, I can close my eyes and walk right to the soap section of the store. Because I know where everything is. Because they have everything in there mapped out, you know, where stuff is. And, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, do that. You have stores that you go into, you know where everything is. You just walk, boom, 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 and you get it. So capitalism, I mean, short definition of that is, you know, if I'm competing with you, we're selling the same product, you know, I'm going to sell mine for $1, and you sell yours for $1.10. You know, a lot of people are going to come to me. you see that and you decide you want to go ahead and drop your price. So we get into a price war, and whoever wins, you know, get the most customers and make the most money, you know, that's who wins it. Then I take over, you know, then if I make a whole lot more than you, I can buy you out and absorb your, you know, your stuff into me. I mean, my corporation, and I'm, you know, I won that one. So the slaves, when they were bought here, they, you know, worked the farms. They planted, you know. Back in the day, we had, they used to grow tobacco around here like crazy. And every summer, if you were lucky, you know, you had a job in the tobacco field, cropping tobacco. I mean, tobacco fields are all over the place, everywhere. So they did tobacco, cotton, corn. Some places did sugar cane. I mean, it depended on where you at. Sweet potatoes. I mean, all kinds of stuff. So the slaves planted all this stuff. The slaves, you know, collected it when it was time to be collected. Did the, you know, job, and then the owners of these plantations would sell these products. They would make money. The slaves wouldn't make, they wouldn't give slaves any of this money. They kept it all to themselves. And then lots of times, you know, there was slavery in the North, but it wasn't as prevalent as it was in the South. So, you know, they would sell a lot of these goods all over. You know, some of these goods would go, you know, up like cotton would go up north, and they would take the cotton, and then they would, you know, do what they got to do to it, make it into cloth, and make clothes, and then sell clothes, or whatever, you know, they did with the product. They would sell the product. They'd make money off of that. Then they would turn around, buy more equipment, buy more products, and it kept going. Only people in this deal that didn't make any money were the slaves. Everybody else made money. There was a program on the History Channel called The Men Who Built America. Actually, they didn't build America. So I don't agree with that title of that, because they didn't build America. Slaves built America. But they don't want you to know that because all of these guys are white. So for years, you know, in the educational system, that's what they kept teaching the kids. They would skirt around the issue of who really built America. And the slaves built America. That's why you had a war. Because the South, I mean, and people around here will try to tell you, and they've been doing this for years, that it wasn't, that the Civil War was not about slavery. It was about states' rights. Yeah, the right to own other people, to do the hard jobs that they were too lazy to do. And they'll keep telling you, no, it wasn't. Yes, it was. Just be honest. Yes, it was. It was. And then when the South lost, the slaves were freed, the plantation owners didn't know what to do. They freaked out because, you know, they owned the place. They don't have to do any work. They had other people doing the work for free. All they did was sit back and collect the money. And that's exactly what they did. So when they had nobody else to do the work, because they weren't about to get out there and do it, they freaked out. And then that, and I'm not, you know, that's not in the program tonight, but then that led to the prison industrial complex that we have in this country, again, where you have black people, again, doing manual labor, again, for free, again. So it's, you know, this country doesn't like, seem to have an attitude and don't like a lot of black folk. But But if they didn't have black folk in this country doing this, you know, doing this work, you know, and then we come to the Mexicans. They're doing the, well, they were until, you know, doing a lot of jobs that, you know, so-called Americans, real, you know, if you want, I ain't gonna call them real, but so-called Americans wouldn't do. So now you got this butthead that's pretending to be president, trying to kick him out. So who's gonna do the job? Who's gonna do the work? So if nobody's out there doing the work, if nobody's out there picking the you know, the vegetable, the stuff's gonna rot. So who's gonna do it? And it's a hot mess. It is a hot mess. And nobody builds anything in this country anymore. Not like they used to. They used to build all kinds of stuff in this country, but now they don't anymore because of what? Because of money. Because of greed. Because of capitalism. You know, if you have to pay somebody in America to make a shirt for, I don't know, $15 an hour, and you have to choose between paying somebody $15 an hour or you can get somebody in Malaysia to make the same shirt for $1 a day, who you gonna get? You're going to make that shirt in Malaysia. It's the same shirt. You make more money off that shirt made in Malaysia because you don't have to pay the person here making $15 an hour plus benefits when you can send it over there and have somebody make it $1 a day with no benefits. And your money piles up. Take that shirt, you know, boom, boom, put it on the market. Somebody buys it. You good. So all of this is it's greed. It's you know, we would think that slavery is dead, but it's not. It just comes under a different name. You know, in my hometown of Lumberton, they used to make the old Chuck Taylors way back in the day. They had a Converse plant, and they used to make Chuck Taylors. They closed the plant and moved overseas, and I want to say Nike bought them out. So Nike makes Chuck Taylors now, but they don't make them in America. They make them in China, I believe, one of those countries over there. So they're paying those people over there a lot less than they paid people over here. And a lot of factories moved from here to overseas, you know. Almost everything you pick up now, it says made in China. Made in China. So this fool in the White House wants to start a war with China, trade war, not an actual war, but a trade war. You know, putting tariffs, and all tariffs are taxes. They don't pay the taxes. We pay the taxes because the price of these goods go up. So, you know, if there's a TV, you know, big screen TV that you want, you know, say it was like $300. And I think I'm not sure. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think what it's 15% tariff or something like that. So now you want that TV. So I got to pay an extra 15% on top of that, plus sales tax. So, you know, TV went up. And we're paying the price for that nonsense. My thing is, if you want to blame somebody, you need to blame the companies for doing that. That's don't blame the people making the product. Blame the corporations that ship their stuff overseas. You know, blame them. And blame the corporations when they get undocumented people working in the companies. Don't blame the people. Blame the corporation. Cheap labor. The cheaper you can get, the more money that you're going to eventually get, that you're going to eventually put into some bank somewhere, so you don't have to pay taxes on it. The whole thing is a scam, and they know it. And there's a lot of people that know how to game the system, and they know it. And they know it. So you have people, you know, making big money doing this stuff. They're paying people next to nothing to make this stuff. They're making money. They're making profits like crazy. They don't, a lot of them don't pay the taxes. They take the money and drop it in a bank overseas and just let it keep piling up. And the workers are getting poor. Corporations are getting richer, and then they're greasing the palms of the politicians, you know, to help them pass certain bills or whatever, so they can make even more money and pass tax cuts that don't help us but help the corporations. So it's a game. Matter of fact, they used to in Wall Street. I should have included the clip, but it's in the oldest show I did, where slaves. I guess you could say slaves were actually traded on Wall Street way back in the day, and it's crazy how that worked. And I think it's in the clip that I did a while ago about slavery and all that kind of stuff. But I wanted to include it in the show tonight, but I found all my clips, so I didn't need it. But it's interesting how they did that, and how sometimes, you know, they don't want to talk about that. They want to talk about everything else, but they don't want to talk about that. And the only way you're going to talk about that, you have to expose it and bring it out and, you know, and talk about it. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play, I've got five clips. The longest one I had, well, I've got two long ones. The rest of them are pretty short, but they have information in them. Let me see the first. Okay. So this first one is not a long one, but it gives information on the Atlantic slave trade, because in order to start talking about it, you got to go to the beginning and then you work your way up. And then that way you'll get a better understanding of what I'm talking about. So let's play this. Be right back.
Slavery. The treatment of human beings as property, deprived of personal rights, has occurred in many forms throughout the world. But one institution stands out for both its global scale and its lasting legacy. The Atlantic slave trade, occurring from the late 15th to the mid-19th century and spanning three continents, forcibly brought more than 10 million Africans to the Americas. The impact it would leave affected not only these slaves and their descendants, but the economies and histories of large parts of the world. There had been centuries of contact between Europe and Africa via the Mediterranean, but the Atlantic slave trade began in the late 1400s with Portuguese colonies in West Africa and Spanish settlement of the Americas shortly after. The crops grown in the new colonies, sugarcane, tobacco, and cotton, were labor-intensive, and there were not enough settlers or indentured servants to cultivate all the new land. American natives were enslaved, but many died from new diseases, while others effectively resisted. And so, to meet the massive demand for labor, the Europeans looked to Africa. African slavery had existed for centuries in various forms. Some slaves were indentured servants, with a limited term and the chance to buy one's freedom. Others were more like European serfs. In some societies, slaves could be part of a master's family, own land, and even rise to positions of power. But when white captains came offering manufactured goods, weapons, and rum for slaves, African kings and merchants had little reason to hesitate. They viewed the people they sold not as fellow Africans, but criminals, debtors, or prisoners of war from rival tribes. By selling them, kings enriched their own realms and strengthened them against neighboring enemies. African kingdoms prospered from the slave trade, but meeting the Europeans' massive demand created intense competition. slavery replaced other criminal sentences, and capturing slaves became a motivation for war rather than its result. To defend themselves from slave raids, neighboring kingdoms needed European firearms, which they also bought with slaves. The slave trade had become an arms race, altering societies and economies across the continent. As for the slaves themselves, they faced unimaginable brutality. After being marched to slave forts on the coast, shaved to prevent lice, and branded, they were loaded onto ships bound for the Americas. About 20% of them would never see land again. Most captains of the day were tight packers, cramming as many men as possible below deck. While the lack of sanitation caused many to die of disease, and others were thrown overboard for being sick or as discipline, the captains ensured their profits by cutting off slaves' ears as proof of purchase. Some captives took matters into their own hands. Many inland Africans had never seen whites before and thought them to be cannibals, constantly taking people away and returning for more. Afraid of being eaten or just to avoid further suffering, they committed suicide or starved themselves, believing that in death their souls would return home. Those who survived were completely dehumanized, treated as mere cargo. Women and children were kept above deck and abused by the crew, while the men were made to perform dances in order to keep them exercised and curb rebellion. What happened to those Africans who reached the New World, and how the legacy of slavery still affects their descendants today, is fairly well known. But what is not often discussed is the effect that the Atlantic slave trade had on Africa's future. Not only did the continent lose tens of millions of its able-bodied population, but because most of the slaves taken were men, the long-term demographic effect was even greater. When the slave trade was finally outlawed in the Americas and Europe, the African kingdoms whose economies it had come to dominate collapsed, leaving them open to conquest and colonization. And the increased competition and influx of European weapons fueled warfare and instability that continues to this day. The Atlantic slave trade also contributed to the development of racist ideology. Most African slavery had no deeper reason than legal punishment or intertribal warfare. But the Europeans who preached a universal religion, and who had long ago outlawed enslaving fellow Christians, needed justification for a practice so obviously at odds with their ideals of equality. So they claimed that Africans were biologically inferior and destined to be slaves, making great efforts to justify this theory. Thus, slavery in Europe and the Americas acquired a racial basis, making it impossible for slaves and their future descendants to attain equal status in society. In all of these ways, the Atlantic slave trade was an injustice on a massive scale, whose impact has continued long after its abolition.
Okay. Now, that sets up the background for what we're talking about tonight. So this next clip, this is a long clip. It's about 20 minutes. But it goes into slavery, and it also gives you the foundation of what we're talking about tonight. And, you know, unfortunately in schools, they skip over a lot of this stuff. So in order to understand it better, you got to kind of dig down and get to the bottom of it. So that's what we're doing tonight on how it also, you know, its effects and how it built this country. It's a lot of people don't want to talk about. So here we go. Be right back.
I'm Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant History Professor from UC Berkeley and author of Accounting for Slavery, Caitlin Rosenthal. Welcome to the program, Caitlin.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, okay, now this is, there are some business terms in here, and you at one point, my understanding is, were a McKinsey consultant and have written on that aspect of business practices. So let's just start. Well, how did you come to write about this? And then I want to just make clear a couple of terms that if we were all consumers of business theory, we would know off the bat. But tell us first how you came to write about this topic.
Sure. Right out of college, I worked as a consultant for McKinsey & Company. And when you're the most junior person on a team there, you're the person who gets the spreadsheet. And you spend a lot of time crunching the numbers to figure out how you can help companies be more profitable. And so I spend a lot of time analyzing data about people who I never met and people who I was never going to get to meet. And the decisions that I was helping people make nonetheless had a big impact on their lives. So I went back to graduate school interested in the history of how data developed over time and how data changed the way people thought about businesses as they got really big. And when I got to graduate school, I first started studying the history of northern textile mills because that was where I assumed the story would be. Kind of from my undergraduate history education, it was all about iron forges and textile mills. And then I quickly realized that the biggest businesses of the early 19th century are actually slave plantations in the West Indies and in the American South. So I started to look at their records and was really surprised to discover that some of them collected as much or more data as the factory counterparts that I had assumed would be the center of the story.
And so it is that. And so, all right. So let's, with that stated, that there is this sort of almost, in some ways, a lost history of this of these business practices. Talk about. Let's, I guess, introduce it this way to a certain extent. There's a theory or a narrative, anyways, of mutual progress that. That in some way slavery was a hindrance to capitalism, and that as capitalism grew and these type of business practices grew, it was sort of emancipating in some respect, but it really turns out to be not the case.
Yeah, that's kind of the narrative I found to be a prominent as a consultant, just a kind of an assumption that creativity and innovation go together with advancing freedom. You know, that the coming of capitalism is all about free labor. And what I find is something pretty different, which is that the North and the South were advancing together. And this is in some ways something historians have known for a long time, but there haven't really been business histories. So we haven't seen how these practices have unfolded in a business setting. There's a management scholar who actually described this as the denial of slavery in management studies, because he said if you go read even histories of the South, you don't even have to go back to the archival records, which is what I did, but to begin to understand how advanced and sophisticated some of these plantations were. And this scholar, Bill Cook, argues that this is kind of so easy to find that it counts as denial. So what I did was to go back into the records themselves and ask how they compared to the management milestones that we usually associate with the rise of American business. So the book is not about like the average slaveholder. It's about the people who would have been in our business histories already, the kind of Carnegies and Rockefellers of American slavery, who, but for the terrible and brutal nature of their business, would probably already be part of our national story because they were so innovative.
And in fact, their innovations were far more prominent and durable than we commonly understand.
Yeah, so they're using – I structured a book around the big milestones of modern business history, which include things like what people call the M-form corporation, but it's basically like a modern organizational hierarchy, and also the accounting innovation of depreciation. Those are things that both were appearing on plantations relatively early. And in the case of depreciation, you have only the most innovative corporations – using depreciation until the late 19th century, and planters are using it to depreciate people from the 1850s.
Okay, yeah, that was, now we're getting into the sort of the terms, and as we talk about these milestones in business histories, this is where I think we're going to need some, or I certainly am, going to need some extra help. So when we talk about, let's start with first the idea of depreciation. How is that used and I don't think it's changed really in business parlance in a couple hundred years, maybe, or at least 150 years. But explain to us what depreciation is so that we can appreciate no pun intended, what it means in this context.
Certainly. So depreciation is when you have a big fixed cost, like I'll just give you the example of the railroads, because that's what the canonical example usually is. So a railroad and railroad tracks and locomotives cost a huge amount of money. And you make that investment usually all at once. But as you're calculating your profitability, you want to figure out how to spread that investment out over time. And wear and tear means it's going to decline in value. So you take your train and you say it's worth this much today, and then you figure out how to value it over time, which has implications both for your profits, and then today it has big tax implications, so that was less so at the time. So it's a strategy for figuring out the changing value of long-lived capital assets. As Alfred Chandler, a famous business historian, calls them, he says, complex, long-lived capital assets are the origination of depreciation. And so on plantations, I mean, the most complex and long-lived of capital assets is a person. And people are unique because, unlike most factories and machines, people are unique for lots of ways, I mean, which we could talk about in a minute, but they enslaved people appreciated in value as they grew older, as they learned skills, as planters invested in what we would call human capital. Then their value peaked in their late teens and 20s. And then already into their 30s, people are beginning to depreciate and decline in value as they get older.
And so what does this tell us about the way that, I mean, so what is that, I mean, what does that tell us that these depreciation, depreciation perspective was applied to human beings? Because we don't see that in modern day worker or even in contemporary workers who were actually paid, right, and had the freedom to leave. Did we?
So this is like a yes and no. Of course, we don't depreciate people in the way that planters did, in that same kind of reductive way that assumes you have power over someone. But of course, human capital is a huge part of the ways businesses think about strategy. And planters didn't call it human capital, but they clearly do calculations of human capital, and they assess how they're changing over time to make business decisions and to figure out how to allocate the people who are the capital that's the basis of their business.
Okay, will you explain that term to us too, human capital? I mean, what do we mean by that in business parlance? And then how is that used in the context, or not used, but I guess assessed in the context of slavery? Because it seems to me that on some level, the whole key to slavery from the perspective of the plantation owners is that this is not human capital. This is more or less, these people, our slaves, are more or less like the things that till the land or something. They're machinery.
So you know, when we talk about human capital, we talk usually about investments and skills. Like businesses might train someone to increase their human capital. And plantations are interesting because they see the exact same thing. I have ledgers from the British West Indies that have something like 20 different occupational categories, many of which are skilled, like a skilled blacksmith or a skilled cooper who made barrels. And even within those skilled categories, you have enslaved people who are the head person within that category, so they're also in charge of being managers. Now, today, businesses worry about losing their human capital, and planters didn't have to worry about people quitting. They had to worry about people running away, escaping from the plantation. They had to worry about death. But they have many of their plant problems really radically simplified. But to get to your other point, what's interesting is that planters are at the one treating people as skilled labor, but at the same time, you know, the record I just described that has those 20 occupational categories is immediately followed by an identical record for livestock. Either that instead of the categories of labor, you have sheep and mules and categories of animals. So people are being treated really as animals and machines, but also planters understand that what makes them so valuable is the fact that these are people. So they're able to do both kinds of accounting and move back and forth between them.
And so when we talk about the way that they treated human capital, I guess, and also, you know, this concept of depreciation, with the workers as if they're a piece of equipment they bought. I mean, how does this implicate? I mean, were these like founding these practices? Do they end up becoming like the building blocks of modern day capitalism and I guess business practices?
So the story I tell is not exactly an origin story. When I first started writing the book, I didn't really understand what a big deal slavery was. I mean, it sort of sounds silly to say that, but I only slowly began to understand how foundational it was to the American economy. So when I first started writing, I was looking for, you know, the single link that was going to show that plantation slavery influenced Northern scientific management. And I did find some links, but not really a smoking gun that said this is the foundation. What I uncovered instead is the fact that the Northern and Southern economies and also the Northern and the Caribbean economies are just deeply intertwined for the whole 150 years where capitalism is emerging. So I came to think it was sort of, I was asking the question wrong if I was looking for the single link, because really what you have is two economies that are intertwined. All those textile mills that I thought the story was going to begin in are, of course, weaving slave-grown cotton. And these people are in communication all the time. So it's not really about one link. It's really about the whole story being more complicated.
And that, I mean, and I think there's been a lot of, I mean, we've interviewed over the past couple of years several historians who have gone back and sort of reassessed the import of cotton, frankly, and I guess maybe other, you know, tobacco, but primarily cotton in terms of driving the economy, not just of the South, but of the North as well. And so was there a sharing of back and forth in terms of business practices? I mean, the gist of it is just that really how sophisticated these big plantations were run, which I guess is a surprise because why?
Well, it's an interesting question. How surprising is this? When I was a consultant, I used to joke that insights needed to be surprising or resolve controversy. And the interesting thing about this fact is that people either find it super surprising, like they had no idea because they really believe that slavery was backwards from the perspective of innovation, or they find it totally unsurprising. They're like, I never thought about business practices, but of course, knowing what I know about slavery, I must. So it's a kind of a it's like a litmus test for where we are in our national conversations about slavery, which is that some people have begun to get it, and they start to read about plantation business practices, and it still really tells them a lot to see the granularity of how they innovated with violence. But the most illuminating thing is that a whole other set of people find this stuff totally shocking.
Right.
The idea that planters were using basically paper spreadsheets to calculate the output per person in a very similar way to what we do now.
So the shocking part is that there is some type of presumption that exists among some people that slavery was somehow an aberration in some way, and that it was a function of the people who would have slaves were not business people. They were just, there was something anomalous, I guess, about it. But in fact, it's really part of a tradition and almost in some respects sort of seamlessly slides into an era where people aren't slaves, right? I mean, like how much of our business practices that we have today in terms of management techniques and control of workers is, if not a descendant of those practices, but at very least, you know, looks very similar to those practices.
So, I mean, a huge proportion. The book talks about the standardization of forms. It talks about the way we developed our hierarchies. It talks about this question of depreciation, which is linked to the whole question of human capital. And it also discusses productivity analysis. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find another big area where data science and accounting have kind of are totally different. So those are, I mean, some four of the main innovations, and the plantation is there for all of them. Now, you're right to say that, you know, the plantation isn't necessarily the foundation, but it's the part of the environment from which these practices emerged. And there are all kinds of things that just look strikingly similar. So if we go back to the topic of depreciation, there's two ways that people generally talk about depreciation, a straight line depreciation and a mark-to-market depreciation. These were chatted a lot about during the mortgage crisis because which way you chose had implications for how valuable people thought things were. Straight line is just that you depreciate the same amount every year. So you say, I have something that's worth $20, and you just reduce it a dollar every year. Mark-to-market says each year you look to see what the market value is, and you change that market. So there's a planter named James Green Carson who, for all of his slaves, he has a formula, and he values enslaved people from age zero to 10 with a straight line, doing straight line appreciation. They increase by $50 the first year of life, because if you survive the first year, you're likely to survive longer, then $25 for each additional year. But then when he gets to 10, he says, look, the diversity of these people means that values diverge. And so he starts marking them to the market value, which changes over time and can go up and down from year to year.
The market value depending on what skills they have. Maybe the blacksmith
on what skills they have, but...
Go ahead.
So what skills they have, but also how the market prices are changing, because the value of slaves over most of the antebellum period is going up. So the value of slaves in 1960 is a high value. They've proven a very good investment for people, both because of the labor that they're extracting, but also because the market value of slaves has gone up.
Now, depreciation at that time, was not a function, it wasn't something you did because of taxes. It was because to determine just what are my profits and what are my assets, right, at that time as a plantation owner?
Exactly. You have the planters I've seen calculating depreciation want to know how much money they're making from year to year, and not all of that is coming in cash. A lot of it's coming in the form of their investments. So they calculate the value of those investments over time. There's a famous, I mean, not that famous, but a relatively well-known quote from Thomas Jefferson where he suggests that people should invest as much as they can in slaves because in addition to the labor that they give you, they also appreciate about, I think he says, 5% from year to year. So you get both the labor and a capital increase.
And I guess
you also might be doing this to show to a bank. I mean, you can get a loan collateralized by slaves, so you might be taking this to show to a bank.
I know that's not. I know that's scholarship that has been done that preexisted, but tease that out for us, because I mean this is I guess theoretically, as I sit here and talk into this microphone, I bought this microphone 5, 6, 7 years ago, or 8 years ago, let's say it cost $400. If I needed to get a loan and wanted collateral, I don't know how much I could get based on this microphone, but this microphone would function as collateral, or the video camera or the computers, theoretically, I guess. They wouldn't have that much value. But so this is another difference between...
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing, but enslaved people were super valuable. And they could be moved from place to place and used to collateralize loans to buy more land and to buy more people.
And so their value to a plantation owner was not just in the work that they produced, but the potential work they could produce or value they could produce.
I mean, absolutely. Some of the most horrifying records from plantations are like slave trade, not from plantations, from slave traders, have values for a woman with her first child. And a woman with her first child was especially valuable, not only because of the child, but because this is a woman who is fertile. She's going to reproduce again. This is a woman who's going to survive childbirth because she survived it before. So she's being valued based on her own potential labor, but also on her potential reproductive labor and the labor of the children who are going to be enslaved as well. So planters are forward-looking, thinking about how assets are going to grow over time.
I want you to listen to this, and then at the end of this, you're going to hear my analysis of what Donald has said, because it's crazy stuff, and I'm going to show you and prove to you how crazy it really is. Here we go.
America's worst social injustice was slavery. Today, some people argue that America's success was a product of that slavery, that capitalism thrived in America because whites stole labor from black people. We can say thievery was a critical element to the expansion of American empire and the establishment of the American way of life. That was leftist writer Michael Eric Dyson. He and lots of people believe slavery gave American capitalists a head start because they didn't have to pay workers. So they say slavery made capitalism successful. But economist Don Boudreau says the opposite's true.
No, what do you mean? That's just a crazy notion. Slavery has been around for about 10,000 years, since the beginning of the agricultural revolution. If slavery were important and instrumental in starting capitalism, we have to wonder why did it take 10,000 years for it to start? Also, if you look at the places in the world where capitalism first took off, Britain and Holland, there was big advert of slavery early. Look at the Americas. In North America, in the northern part of the United States, slavery was gotten rid of long before it was gotten rid of in the southern part, and the northern part was the capitalist part, the wealthier part.
More prosperous in almost every way.
More prosperous for the rich and even for the middle classes in the north and in the south.
But there's a logic to it, that if you could get free labor from some workers, then those capitalists who are making the money from that ought to do better.
Well, they're not capitalists. The plantation owners did really well. They got rich, but everybody else remained poor. Slavery is a system, it's an economic system quite at odds with capitalism. Capitalism requires innovation, it requires consumer sovereignty. Slavery is none of that. Slavery keeps everything static, and that's what the South was prior to the U.S. Civil War. That's what the North was not, which is why the North was booming and the South was not.
On capitalism-hating MSNBC, though they do seem to like making money for themselves. But anyway, on MSNBC, Reverend Otis Moss said, don't blame Christianity for slavery, as some do. Blame capitalism.
Those who were the slaveholders who claimed Christianity, but it was really capitalism and drag.
Capitalism and drag.
That's nuts. There's nothing more opposite of capitalism than slavery. Slavery is keeping people unfree. Capitalism is unleashing people's freedom to spend their money as they want and to work as they want.
So what's this about, do you think? I mean, there's just lots of it. I look at a Huffington Post headline, how slavery led to modern capitalism. Daily Beast, how slavery gave capitalism its start. This is around.
The best I can figure it out, John, is that people want, a lot of people don't like capitalism, and so if you can tarnish capitalism by claiming it somehow is connected with slavery, it makes it look bad. But in history, where slavery exists, capitalism doesn't exist. When capitalism emerged, that's when slavery was gotten rid of. It's no coincidence that Great Britain, the home of the Industrial Revolution, was one of the first countries to get rid of slavery. Brazil, on the other hand, didn't get rid of slavery until 1888. And to this day, it's not a capitalist nation, and it's certainly a lot poorer still than most people in the United States and Western Europe.
And America didn't really prosper until after the Civil War, when slavery was ended.
Decades after slavery was ended, yes.
One of your points is that slavery is not as efficient as people would think it would be.
No, that's right. Slavery is efficient for very, very mechanical tasks, growing tobacco and growing cotton. If you're a plantation owner, you might do well by having slaves pick your cotton. If you're a factory owner, you don't want slaves in your factory. It's simply too easy for them to sabotage. It's too easy for them to shirk in 1,001 different ways that even the best overseer cannot monitor and correct for.
And back to your earlier point, people hate capitalism.
Yeah.
They associate it with social injustice.
Yeah.
What's that about?
I don't know. Capitalism is a system of voluntary and mutual exchanges. You don't have to participate if you don't want.
People don't get it. They hate it.
I know, and I think they're mistaken. They're wholly mistaken. They're right. They don't get it, and that's the problem. See, that's what you do. You help them to try to get it.
I'm trying.
Yeah.
Thank you, Don Boudreau.
Slavery, capitalism in drag, and the seed to America's vast wealth. Now, every now and then, I'll deal with some of these talking heads on Fox News, such as Stossel. Now, this is going to be about what he and his guests is saying on his show. It is true that chattel slavery was the biggest builder of vast wealth for pale-skinned Americans. That's an undeniable fact. Donald Boudreau is a nut and a liar. First, he attempts to distract by mentioning 10,000 years and slavery. This is not about 10,000 years and slavery, but it's about 400 years of slavery in the United States. Slavery is the purest form of capitalism. And the definition of capitalism is the maximization of profits. Labor costs are generally the biggest capital expenditure. The fact is basic economics. Therefore, I question why Stossel would bring this quack onto his show to support his own idiotic quackery. Donald then distracts with a phony statement of slavery starting capitalism. No one said that slavery is or was necessary to jumpstart capitalism. Distractions. Then he makes the silly mistake of comparing Britain and Holland to the United States relative to slavery. Okay. All right. Now, that's like comparing night and day. Britain and Holland had developed societies. They had developed economies where people had jobs with wages. Those societies, the workers, would reject any introduction of a large-scale infrastructure of slavery. Almost everything here in the United States was raw. It was rugged. It required massive manpower to turn the raw resources into capital. And the raw resources were immense, which required an immense amount of human capital, i.e., chattel slavery, primarily African chattel slavery. Britain and Holland did not require such. Slavery was gotten rid of in the northern part of the United States because that is where pale-skinned people were first entering into the United States. And why were they coming? They were first looking for good jobs, good-paying jobs, or some of them were looking to start a business, their own business. And that was not compatible with slavery. Good-paying jobs and slavery are not compatible. This was incompatible, as I said, with slave labor, which would drive down the wages that pale-skinned workers desired. And they were not going to tolerate that. So it had nothing to do with morality as to why the North got rid of slavery before the South. It had everything to do with the fact that people were coming in through that harbor there in New York, not at some harbor in South Carolina. That's just the truth. Those are the facts. Now, therefore, now you can call the call to get rid of slavery in many of the northern states was for that reason. It was so that pale-skinned people could have better paying jobs, higher wages. Donald, Donald, he also makes a false statement about the South. For a long time, the southern states were extremely wealthy. In fact, there was a period of time when that region of the United States was the most wealthy region in the history of the United States. No, the northern states were not noticeably more wealthy until after the Civil War. Not before the Civil War, after the Civil War. That's when the whole economic thing switched. Slavery was all about capitalism. Again, what's the definition of capitalism? Pure capitalism, it means the maximization of profit. And then what is the largest capital expenditure? Usually, it's human capital. It's labor. So not only did the plantation owners benefit from slavery, but other not so wealthy pale-skinned Americans also benefited from it, much like an owner of a fleet of automobiles, of cars today. These plantation owners would rent out enslaved blacks to perform labor for the poorer whites. That's right. They would rent them out, not only for labor, but they would also rent them out because the Africans were good performers. They were good with music, good with the dancing. They would rent them out for entertainment, much like the phony Jews do today in the entertainment industry, driving that industry. That's right. So therefore, his statement about everybody else remained poor is a lie. All these other pale-skinned people, they remained poor. That's a damn lie. There were poor pale-skinned Americans, but not as implied by this guy. The statement that slavery is an economic system that is at odds with capitalism is another lie. Slavery was all a part of capitalism, a part of pure capitalism, the maximization of profit. It has long been a significant part of capitalism, which, by the way, was not invented in Europe. Talking about capitalism, it existed long before those European states rose to power. Capitalism requires innovation. Yes, it does. But the enslaved were often innovating. But because they were chattel, meaning that they were owned by pale-skinned people, as chattel, any ideas that these Africans had, any inventions that they came up to make their lives easier, you know, necessity is the mother of all inventions. You know, you want to make your job easier if you're out there laboring in the sun from before the sun comes up to when the sun goes down. You want to make your life easier. So you had blacks who were thinkers, had ideas. They would invent things. But those inventions were owned and went into the names of those slave plantation owners. So what the hell is consumer sovereignties? Now, he says something about consumer sovereignties. What the hell is that? Okay? Now, probably more BS. That's what I think. It's probably just more BS on the part of Donald. Now, his statement about slavery keeping everything static is just sheer nonsense. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, which got its investment capital from what? From slavery. Things were moving. Money was moving. Goods were moving. Commodities were moving. And yes, slaves were a big part of what we call commodities, which were for a long time the most valuable commodity on Wall Street. In New York City. That's right, New York City. So New York City, South Carolina, they were all connected. You were producing the cotton there in South Carolina and other places, and then it was shipped on up to New York City, where the phony Jews up there would then take care of it in the garment industry. They were the big money makers. That's why they have so much money today in Wall Street. That's why they control Wall Street today. That's why they control the Federal Reserve today. Because they have been in this dirty business of chattel slavery for generations and generations and generations. Now imagine, in the 1600s, Africans fetching more than $1,600 on the commodity trading blocks, such as Wall Street. That's right, $1,600, as far back as the 1600s now, in this country. That's right. So people were not paying that huge amount of money, and that was a hell of a lot of money back then, for something that they would not bring home and expect it to bring them a huge profit, a huge return. Again, this guy was incorrect about the South not booming at the time of the Civil War. It's just a damn lie. It's not true. It was the great wealth that the South had accumulated that made it possible for them to go militarily against the North. That wealth came primarily from what? From slavery. As Billy Preston once sung the song, "Nothing from nothing leaves nothing." In other words, it was slavery that literally turned this raw North American territory into something. Prior to that, there was nothing. It was just raw. So it was brawn and that built the great wealth of the United States of America. So anyway, that was the lie that the guy was telling, and I had to correct that because, you know, you got a lot of these people out here who listens to Fox News, and they mislead these devils. I just totally mislead them. That's totally unacceptable. So you got the real truth right here. I mean, slavery was a very, very bad thing. And it really brought out turned out some very, very negative things for generations of the African peoples here in the United States of America. This is T. West.
Colette in Los Angeles. Hey, Colette, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just kind of wanted to dovetail in on the fact that capitalism and the development financially this country is solely due to slavery. This country was built on the wealth of slavery, and I think that's an issue regardless of the tactical or the analytical part of what our forefathers came up with. Without that labor, this country would have never developed the way that it has. And in addition, we talk about today the working conditions. The problem is that the powers that be cannot move away from that model of slave labor. I'll take my response off there. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Colleen, Colette. Yeah, I think that the legacy of slavery is still with us, and I'm not talking about the obvious stuff like, you know, institutional racism and structural racism and all those sorts of things. The institution of slavery was in early America was a classic expression of feudalism, of European feudalism. Basically, the peasants were slaves. They were the property, literally the property of the landowners. You know, slavery has been practiced in other forms by other names throughout history. The Greeks had slaves, the Romans had slaves, and you're absolutely right. This country would not have developed the way it did, or at least it wouldn't have developed as rapidly as it did without slave labor. And I believe this to be true. I read this in one of the histories of America some years back, that the quote value, and see, it's represented as labor, but the quote value of all the slaves in the South was greater than all the industrial and land property in the North. So, you know, it was a very big deal. But I would say that the part of the legacy of slavery that's still with us is this idea that businesses are basically kingdoms, that labor is disposable, that if a company wants to, you know, is in search of greater profits, they can simply pick up their factory and move someplace else. There's a fundamental question here, and this is the fundamental question that, you know, if you're going to have an argument with a libertarian, you want to ask: is the economy here to serve society, we the people? Or are we the people here to serve the owners, masters, overlords of the economy? Which is it? Now, libertarians would say the latter, that we the people are here to serve those who own the economy, the makers. We are the takers. Right? That would be their sales pitch. And that's essentially the Republican pitch. A Democrat or a progressive would say, no, the economy is here to serve we the people. Which raises the question, how do you construct an economy that serves the people? And, you know, we've done this before, or at least an economy that served white men. You know, we did this from the 30s to the 80s. And we could do it again in a far more inclusive way. And you do that by shifting power away from basically the feudal lords, the slave owners, whatever comparison you want to make, to the people, so that they're no longer slaves and serfs. They're You know, they have some say in things. You could do this with economic co-ops. You do this with unions. You do this with labor-friendly policies like, you know, paid time off. In other words, setting the rules of the game by having government regulate the game of business. You can't exploit people beyond, in these ways. This is, you know, no child labor. Here's a minimum wage. Here are workplace health and safety rules. Here are environmental pollution rules. And it's very straightforward stuff. But this is the core issue here.
According to an article in the Wall Street Journal, and I quote, under current law, U.S. companies can defer taxes indefinitely on the profits they say they have earned overseas until they repatriate that money back to the U.S. So wake up, America, and smell the coffee. I would welcome your opinion as to the truth of my following statements. 1. All emperors, kings, queens, aristocrats, conglomerates, and large manufacturing companies, any profit-making corporation, all wish to achieve cheap labor. Egypt, Rome, Spain, England, France, etc., all use slave labor for hundreds of years. Slave labor was used up to and through the 19th and into the 20th century. Slave labor was continued with the advent of Germany's National Socialist Party and the enslavement of Poland, Czechoslovakia, Holland, Denmark, Norway, and a large part of Russia. Not to forget the 300 years of American slavery here in the good old USA. Plus, in Germany, all the Jews and the Catholics. Those who couldn't or wouldn't work were put to death. By 1942, several million Europeans were working for companies like Krupp and Schindler, cheap slave labor. The immigration to America in the late 19th century and early 20th century supplied cheap labor. The Irish, the Italians, the Latins, all contributed to our much-needed cheap labor force. 2. In 1940, we conscripted our boys into military service to fight for, quote, democracy if we were attacked. Roosevelt began the Lend-Lease for Britain and Russia. Our large manufacturers like McCormick Tractor and General Motors had to retool in a few months. Those big companies found a severe shortage of cheap labor. Suddenly, radio, advertising, newspapers, stories said Uncle Sam needs patriotic women to go to work for democracy. That's when Rosie the Riveter became famous and the men were replaced by cheap female labor. 3. The corporations have taken over America and the American government. They have written a tax code for themselves that allows them to escape paying taxes. They send jobs overseas and then don't want to pay the taxes on the money they make there. This is all a way of putting the tax burden on you and me and all we ordinary working Americans while sheltering the rich and the multinational corporations. The big corporation mouthpieces will tell you that these tax laws keep businesses from relocating overseas. I say, if they want to leave America, let them go. Why should they have the benefit of being an American company without doing their fair share to make America a better place? If they want to exploit cheap labor markets around the world, go ahead. They just shouldn't expect Americans to buy their products when we can make everything we need in this country. Remember when we used to actually make things in this country? We can go back to that. It's these big corporations who have turned the American dream into a fairy tale. Don't let them turn us into a demoralized, uneducated, cheap labor force. 4. The search for cheap labor has resulted in the destruction of our democracy. Our people are once again ill-clothed, ill-fed, ill-housed. We are in a deep recession from which we may never recover, and the dollar could get devalued. Only the very, very rich will survive. Thank you for listening.
Okay. So, that's pretty much the show for tonight. And I hope you learned something from tonight's show. I'm going to keep this on point and on time because I have to get up early in the morning and go to work. Speaking of work. But I hope you learned something from this. And if you missed any part of it, you can always go back in the archives and catch up on the part that you missed or whatever. I will be back next Tuesday, new time, 7 o'clock. And next Tuesday night's topic is, since football season starts this Thursday, we're going to talk about Colin Kaepernick and Jay-Z. And you're like, what do they got to do with football? Well, we'll talk about that next week. So until then, I will talk to you next week. Same time, same channel. Peace out.